On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply. At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Epic is a word oft applied to cinema, but rarely can it have been more appropriately used than to describe the work of Peter Jackson and Philippa Boyens. For along with writing partner Fran Walsh, it is they that have brought us both The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit trilogies, not to mention King Kong. Their latest project is the equally ambitious Mortal Engines, which they wrote and produced, based on the novel of the same name by Philip Reeve. Mortal Engines is based on the mind-boggling premise that cities of the future have been mounted on wheels and motorised in order that they can hunt and prey upon each other. The film score is provided by Tom Holkenborg, also known as Junkie XL, a previous guest on the show, and it is with his cue, Welcome to London, that we begin, as Peter and Philippa explain what so appealed about Reeve's post-apocalyptic vision. Philippa, Peter, welcome to Soundtrack, and it's such a pleasure to have you both on because, well, you've been very much part of myself and a lot of our listeners' kind of movie life, I would say, for the past 20-odd years, so thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk first about Mortal Engines. Why did you want to tell this story, and what was it that you connected with these books that are, what, nearly 20 years old now?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I first read them, there was four books, you know, which was actually good because I was able to binge on them like a Netflix show. So, and that was about 10 years ago when I read the first one, and then straight into the second, the third, the fourth. And so, I really, my introduction to it was an entire sort of life story of Hester and Tom. It was like, it wasn't just the first story, and I just thought it was incredible the world that it's set in, but also them as characters and what Philip Reeve, the author, did. In surprise, you know, so many twists and turns, and unexpected things, and their characters develop in ways that you're really interesting, complex, layered ways. And so that was, I just thought, wow, these would make a great film. And I don't, you know, I never read books with that plan in mind. I just read books. I mean, somebody told me that these were fun books, and I thought I'd enjoy them. And so anyway, I came away from having finished the fourth one, quiet about the film rights, and they were available, and we got the film rights in 2008. And we're busy at the time. Tintin and District 9 were just happening, so we had to sort of couldn't jump onto the Mortal Engines project immediately. And just when we did, we started a little bit of work, and then the Hobbit came along, which was not really expected because of that was a
small thing.
But the rights to the Hobbit were always entangled, and we didn't think they'd ever get clear, so we didn't have any expectation. And then Warner suddenly called us and said, "Well, we want to get on the way with the Hobbit." So Mortal Engines actually got shelved for a while, and came back to it after the Hobbit. But however, that's the, you know, it was the characters. It's a great world. It's an incredible world, but it was a character story that got me hooked.
Was it easy to write the screenplay for it in terms of knowing what you would focus on with those stories and those characters?
I think the words writing and easy never go.
No.
Never use them in the same sentence. Huh?
No, I'm thinking about a few 4 o'clock in the morning.
I thought you were going to say a few four-letter words. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I could do that as well.
4 o'clock in the morning, four-letter words.
No, I do. There were a few 4 o'clock in the morning sessions on this one. Mm. Wow. But it was a lot of fun. It wasn't a chore. You know, we're so incredibly lucky and privileged to be able to do what we're doing. And, you know, I felt like one of the things that I loved about working on, obviously, Lord of the Rings, but also this book, was that you get to step into that world every day.
I was just going to say that you know, Tolkien had this great vision for Middle-earth that he wrote, and not just The Lord of the Rings, but other books. But in a way, I think that Philip Reeves' world is comparable, because it was the 4 books in the series when we first jumped on board in 2008. But when we actually, after The Hobbit was finished and we came to really sit down and write it, he'd written 3 more prequel books. So in a way, he'd fleshed out a world that's almost as big as Tolkien's world. And even though we were just making the first book, you know, in the 4-book series, I mean, we had the rights to all of the books, and we still do have the rights to all of the books. So we were able to dip into those to get a feel for the greater world. So, you know, which was really, as a writer in particular, that's a really helpful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was interesting working with Fran, who is, you know, not here, but is such an important element of the storytelling in any film that we tackle. One of the places she first starts, you know, when we sit down and start looking at that blank page and where are we going to start, is the ideas that inform the storytelling. And this story is so rich. It's so full of so many. And it's not just the obvious, which is the uniqueness of the world, mm-hmm. giant moving cities, you know, I mean, immediately you want to see that, right?
Yeah.
But it was more than that. It was about the underlying themes in the story, such as, you know, the parenting that goes mm-hmm. on and what being a parent really, truly is. And also being
lack of as well.
Yeah, the lack of parenting.
Yeah, so it's not really a film about parenting.
No, it's not. It's not a parenting film.
Not really.
I'm talking about underlying ideas.
It would be a really boring movie.
Yes.
And this is far from boring.
It is far from boring. but what it does do is it gives you these incredibly rich characters,
yeah.
those sort of ideas. Yeah. Because actually the true parent in this story is like no parent you've ever seen before.
Yeah.
Half human, half cyborg psycho killer.
Yeah.
Who actually ends up having the purest heart of all these characters, really.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because we were going to talk about music, and you worked with Junkie XL Thomas, who's been on the show previously.
Mm.
And in that particular scene where we see his purest heart, that's all I'm going to say, so no spoilers. The music in that specific scene, the hairs on my arms just gone on end thinking about it. It's so beautiful. Can we talk a little bit about why Thomas was the right man for the job and the conversations you had with him as, you know, as producers on this as well? Because Christian was the director on this, but I imagine you guys were fully involved in that.
Oh, sure. I mean, Thomas is hopefully this is the first film of many that we'll do with Thomas. I mean, that's the best thing you can say about someone. You come out of an experience and you want to do it again. He's absolutely terrific in every possible way. He's on our side. He's not someone who's doing his music and, you know, our suggestions are not welcome. I mean, he listens to us. He's collaborative. He's part of the team, and he really digs deep into the movie. I so admired the way that he, not just threw himself time-wise into doing the score, but emotionally, he just got so wrapped up in the characters, which you want your composer to do that, because that's where the music comes from. It comes from his heart, from his soul. That's where he goes to find the music. And when you see that he's gone down the rabbit hole and he's gone into the world, you think, okay, now the music's going to be fantastic. Mm. And it certainly was, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, and he's really original too. Mm. I mean, right down to how he creates that music.
I mean, he, you know, we didn't want an electronic score, and nor did he, but we got something better than an orchestral score, better than an electronic score. He has this incredible technical ability, which I wasn't even aware that you could do it, where he can record sounds and crazy nutcase sounds and turn them into orchestral instruments and play them like an orchestra. So you're getting an orchestral score, but instead of it being, you know, a violin playing, you're getting some bloody pipe that he's banging on some tank that's making some echo, and he's manipulated that on the computer to sort of sound like a violin, but it's not. And so it's traditional music. It's not just some crazy electronic stuff, which you know, but it's coming from a place that's not really an orchestra, but it's orchestral. I thought his creativity and imagination in doing that stuff was amazing and suited the film perfectly.
As soon as the film opens, really, you're kind of, the music does a really important job, I think, in terms of it kind of sets up Jeopardy almost, I think, kind of straight away. And it just, for me, that kind of shows you how powerful, when it's right, the music can be in terms of telling you so much more than words or narrative can, even before you've started, really.
Yeah, but you know what else he did was the music works so beautifully with the soundscape of the film. Yeah. And the sound in this film is some of the best sound, I think, has ever come out of some of our, you know, sound.
Well, that's another thing that he was very focused on, which again I was full of admiration for, is he wanted to have lots of meetings with the sound designers. He wanted to say, well, let's decide what they're doing, what I'm doing, and whatever they're doing, I want to write music that's going to work with their sound effects. And so, you know, we haven't really had that experience of normally a composer does their score and sound effects guys do their sound effects, and you're in the mixing stage trying to make the two work together. But he doesn't work that way, which is great. He wants to work with the sound designers to make sure they're not stepping on each other's toes and everything.
And they don't.
It's fantastic.
I was always a little bit nervous that this was going to be a noisy film. And by noisy, I mean, you know, you've got, well, you start with giant moving cities, they're not exactly quiet. But what they did and what the music reinforces is instead of that, what you get is a sense of power. Mm-hmm. So instead of a noisy cacophony of an engine, what you get is this deep, low rumble. And that can, and then you feel them when they put their foot on the gas, so to speak, and chase down this smaller town, and you feel that rev up, and then the music comes with it and all of that sort of stuff. And then the contrast, which also happens in the film, is when the city's not there and everything goes quiet, and Tom reflects that again in the music.
Listen to music when you're writing.
You do
something. It's a good question. But the answer to it, I say, is not as much as we should do. I mean, honestly, because whenever I have done it, I really love it. But you know, sometimes you're working on a scene with the three of us, and you just don't think to put music on, or you're wanting to talk to each other. You know, because when you've got three people writing, it's a conversational event, you know, where you're working on a whiteboard and everyone's talking, and to have music playing would almost be sort of too difficult to have conversation with each other. But occasionally, if we're writing by ourselves, or I'm writing some sort of description of some action, we've divided up the jobs and stuff to do. I mean, I have certainly written with music, but because most of the writing what I do with Fran and Phil, not by myself, it's, yes, and unfortunately music is a bit of an intrusion. But I do play music when I'm thinking about films, and when I'm directing a movie too. When I'm directing a movie, I might often have something playing in the car when I'm driving onto the set. When I'm driving to the studio each day, just something to get my head into it. Yeah, for sure.
I would love to use music more as well, but what we find is often when Fran and I are writing together, we're being the characters, so we actually try and get the lines off the page. Not that either of us are actors, but it is one of those things where you say the line aloud, and you never sort of want to overwork anything too much. And I think if I had a score playing under some of those scenes, I'd probably
be overacting
terribly.
more overacting than you do normally.
Normally, yeah, exactly.
Or singing along to songs.
Yeah, exactly.
Taking the character somewhere completely different. It's also really important to know to not use sound and music, and that can be as effective and as powerful.
Absolutely. I think Christian was very aware of that, wasn't he? He wanted that moment of silence.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's, it's the interesting. Yeah, you can write, you know, and this always happens, and I think it happened on this film too, is you write music for a scene, and then when you're in the mixing stage, you just say, well, let's have a listen to it. Just put the music off, you know, in the mixing stage, and we'll just have a listen to it with the effects only. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but the luxury that you try and do is to write score for everything that you think should have score. You know, and obviously some bits of it you decided are going to be silent. And then to find, see if, and always assess if there's any holes that you can create where even though you've written and recorded a score, you can still take it out. And it can be very, very powerful, but it's always good to have the backup of having music there just in case. Because yeah. You really don't know the answers to some of these questions until you're in the mixing stage, and at that point it's too late to write music, so you sort of tend to have to cover your bases a little bit. And Thomas is fine with that too. He's very happy to write stuff and then have it pulled out because he understands the process. He understands the value of having it and then the creative step where you decide that, you know. And also, if you take music out of a scene, it makes the music, when it comes in next time, much more powerful. It's, you know, it is a balance. And if you get the balance right, you've got the power of silence. And then where you do have a score, it's more powerful than if it's just wall-to-wall music.
The two scenes that really stuck with me were with the scene that we mentioned earlier where Shrek's true heart is kind of shown, and then also when they arrive past the wall as well. And those are kind of just, I don't know what it is specifically about those pieces, but for me they really resonated with me. When you are, what kind of conversations do you have with Thomas about, or do you kind of let him go away, come up with something, and then the conversation starts?
No, you spot them. We do what it's called spotting the movie, which is you do certainly talk about the type of music most of the time. You know, and it's interesting because, like the example that you mentioned where they go through the wall and they see, you know, that music is you know, the imagery is beautiful. It's a part of the world we haven't been to before, a green, lush, gorgeous part of the world. But it's also, you become, at that exact moment that you see this beauty, you instantly realise that this is under danger, you know, and until you see it, you don't appreciate what is under jeopardy, and that this is you're seeing it for the first time and realizing that, God, this is beautiful, but it's about to be destroyed, and the music has to reflect that. So what you generally do with a composer is you just have a sort of conversation we've just had now where you talk about what you want the audience, what you want the music to actually achieve. Because, you know, music is always something that's going to ideally speak to the emotion of the audience, but, you know, it has to speak to the right emotion. So it would have been wrong to just simply play music that says, wow, look how beautiful this is.
Yeah.
You know, it has to do that. I mean, it has to say, look how beautiful this is, but enjoy it because this is about to be obliterated. You know, so as soon as you just set some sort of note that you give to Tom, and that's as far as you need to take it, because that's all that he needs to go away and to come up with their music. But it's all about being on the same page and understanding what the scene has to do.
It's also underscoring a very personal speech for the character of Anna, mm. Anna Fang. And what she's speaking to is freedom,
yeah.
A sense of being free because she was once a slave. And that moment when, you know, just timing it right and getting that sense is when you sweep into that world, that whole other world that you kind of didn't know even existed. That timing, all of that had to come together. And again, that's one of those moments where you're not just working with effects and music, you're working with the voice as well. And getting that mix right is really hard.
Can I take you back just for a second to how you felt about, or what you wanted, how you wanted music to be within The Lord of the Rings, and those, and how that started in that relationship with Howard, and what the conversations were, and you know, it was the start of something that at that point I'm sure you didn't know where it was going to go, and it was going to lead in those films, then the Hobbit films, but and working with him throughout all of that.
Well, there was really only one thing that we wanted with the music, we hoped that we would get with the Lord of the Rings is we wanted some very strong themes. Because it was a series of films and it was characters' ongoing stories, we wanted to, you know, to establish like a theme for the Hobbits, or, you know, that would be in the first film, and then when you know, and it can be used in the second or the third film. We wanted, you know, that idea of continuing themes, which is really what John Williams has done very successfully in his, you know, Star Wars series and things. You just, you know, you know where you are in the story and who you're with, you know, because of the music is taking you there. So that's certainly was our idea going in before we even knew who would ask the composer. And then we had storyboards for the movie and some animatics. And what you always do with the storyboards and the animatics is you make up a little sort of a fake little film, and you film the storyboards and you cut them together, like, you know, two or three seconds per storyboard, and you sort of cut it like a film. You try to make it seem like it's you can watch a movie in this sort of very crude form. And what we do part of that is we get soundtrack albums, and we try to put music to it as well, because, you know, if you're wanting to replicate what a crude version of what the film might be like, music's a big part of it. So we were trying all sorts of different music, because it was just from soundtracks that existed. And for some weird reason, and we'd never have guessed it, the music that was always working best with our animatics was Howard Shore music, from The Fly, from Silence of the Lambs, from one or two other movies he did. And I would have never guessed it. I would have thought that's, you know, The Fly working with the Lord of the Rings animatics and storyboard, that you'd never think. And so we sort of got to the point with the end of that. We sort of thought, God, this stuff that we're getting off of Howard Shore's, and this was a guy that I'd never met him before, never spoken to him. This stuff we're getting off Howard Shore's movies is really working fantastically well. So maybe we should ask Howard if he wants to do the movie. And that was literally exactly how it happened.
Wow. Yeah.
That's true.
That's brilliant.
There's obviously an emotion within his music that resonated with
something. Something.
No, he is. Yeah. He is incredibly emotional. I think he's...
Yeah, but he's also had a dark emotion which suited The Lord of the Rings. It's a melancholy. It's not a rah rah rah. You know, in the way that say that, you know, a John Williams sort of theme might be. It's a melancholy sadness to his music, even the sort of more of the cheerful stuff. Thank you.
I remember my very first piece that I heard, and I actually cried, was when Fran played me "Let There Be a Little More Light," and that moment when he steps forward and you hear that, and you and reveal on Casa Doom. One of those moments where it's like, this is the most perfect combination of someone who truly understands the fabric of the world that Tolkien wrote.
And so what happened, I remember now, is we before we started shooting, there's all this what I talked about happened obviously before we started shooting the movie, doing the storyboards and the music and Howard Shore themes and stuff, Howard Shore soundtracks. And so we contacted him and had a phone call with him, and he was very interested in being involved. And he jumped on a plane and came down to New Zealand, and we were still, you know, some weeks away from shooting. And we rented him a house just down the road, and he said, look, he's going to stay for a couple of weeks. He wants to meet us and learn as much as he can about the film and visit sets that were being built at the time and absorb it all. And he asked for a piano to be put into the room, into the house where we hired from. We did, and then after a few days of him arriving, he called us up and he said, do you want to come round for a cup of tea, and I've got some stuff to play. And we hadn't even started shooting the movie yet, and he played like the Hobbit, the theme for the Hobbits, which is almost identical to what it is in the film, and he had one or two others. He was starting to write the themes before we even shot a single frame of film.
That's amazing. And actually, I have to say,
again, I wish Fran was here because she had a huge part to do with
it. Fran is, and it's true of this movie too, was Thomas. Fran's really the member of our trio who takes on the burden of the music more so than Philip and myself.
I do not have a musical bone in my body.
I don't believe that for a second.
No. I tell you what I did get to do, though, which was on Lord of the Rings, which I will forever be grateful for, was because Howard knew he wanted choir very early on. And I did. Yeah. I got to write lyrics. And actually, you know, he found it really helpful because often what I might come up with when he's asking for a theme or something, you know, helped him think about the moment in another way as well.
Amazing. Mm. Thank you so much, guys. I hope this is maybe the first of. It feels like we need Fran here for episode two, talking more.
We need to do a series on the old stories of.
Let's do it.
There is interesting stories that I forget them all, and then when I'm in an interview like this, they suddenly start to sort of trickle back into my brain because usually my hard drive only holds a certain amount. So it goes into the bin
it's
at the back, and I've got to retrieve all the stuff, and it takes a few minutes.
Well, listen, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It's been lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
From the score to Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, that's Lament for Gandalf, featuring Elizabeth Fraser of the Cocteau Twins, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Peter Jackson and Philippa Boyens. A huge thanks to Peter and Philippa for taking the time to talk to us. Mortal Engines is on general release around the world now, with Junkie XL's score available from our good friends at Backlot Music. Now, we'll put a Spotify playlist for the show up via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to subscribe to the podcast and catch up on all of our previous episodes. Tom Holkenborg, aka Junkie XL, appears in episode 81, in case you're wondering. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do spread the word if you like what you hear. Speaking of which, huge thanks to Simon Brew for the mention in his new monthly magazine, Film Stories, which is well worth checking out. Get subscribing at filmstories.co.uk. Next up, the fabulous Rob Marshall on his new interpretation of Mary Poppins, Mary Poppins Returns. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.